welcome to the latest episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast hosted by Data Protection People. My name is Ollie Rear, and I am joined for the purposes of this intro by producer Miles, as per usual, but also my very special guest today, Carrie James. Good afternoon, both of you.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Do you like that, Carrie?
I mean, I was glad that you waited to get to my name because I think I'd have just laughed. I was just laughing straight away. I'm sorry.
Yeah, listen, I'm awaiting.
I didn't know what the hello Vietnam thing was, so I didn't know what you were actually going to do. With the long hello.
Well, I tried to introduce a little bit of pep to it, but the problem is then it doesn't match the rest of the energy of the podcast, so maybe I need to rethink it. I don't know. Listeners, if you listen to this, please give me some feedback. I want to know, does it work, does it not? I don't know. I'm operating in a vacuum at the minute. Anyway, less said about that, the better. But what we can't sing the praises of highly enough, that's a terrible segue. This week's session was really good, basically, is what I'm trying to say, wasn't it? Carrie, we thoroughly enjoyed that. What you'll notice, we mentioned a couple of times, listener, is that the hour that Carrie and I, hour or so Carrie and I spent talking about retention archiving, today's topic, absolutely flew by. I had no idea where the time went. So we very much enjoyed that, but... Well, there was a couple of key points that we covered, wasn't there, in relation to this, Gary?
Yeah, sort of covered some of the more, sort of not the basic bits of records management, but some of the key concepts, things that you need to think about, some of the, I think it's more the theory behind the practical that we've discussed and the benefits of why you would do records management, but also how it differs from archives and that archives is not just an extended way of saying I'm holding it for longer as retention.
No, for sure, for sure. I keep getting distracted. Today's been difficult. It's a busy office today, so it's been challenging. But we're working in extended circumstances, and we'll make do. But yes, no, I very much enjoyed today's session. I mean, we're going to be doing a second part, basically, listener, because you know it's ultimately a fascinating topic that we barely scratched the surface, despite the fact that we talked easily for an hour. So I think. Producer Miles, 10th of June, we're looking at, because there's a gap in the diary.
There is a gap for the 10th of June, yeah. So we will have the next couple of weeks, we've got Carrie back again for Data Breaches Part 1 and Part 2. And then we've got the Jubilee Special with yourself and David Holmes on the 3rd of June. And then we've got an open slot on the 10th of June. So we figured we would fit in retention and archiving Part 2 on that week there.
Is that... Dave's lovely Jubilee.
The lovely Jubilee special.
No.
Terrible. Yeah. And
the dad jokes in this team are just so extreme.
It's Dave. Hey, that wasn't even me. Like that's his one, but he'd be furious if he found out that we hadn't done at least one dad joke. And
well, Rob hit us with a dad joke in this week's session in the
yes,
chat.
Yes, he did. I saw that.
For the benefit of the listener who wasn't able to, won't be able to see exactly what he said. I'm trying to find it on this.
What is it? Records not to be confused with the ones you put in a record player.
Dad jokes are a Rob specialty. And also in Dave's absence, worth noting that you, Ollie, took on Dave's soapbox moment for this week's session as well.
I did indeed, mate. Yes. I did indeed. Listen, someone's got to do it. But, you know, it comes naturally to some of us, shall we say. Myself and Dave included. But no, very, very good session today. Very much enjoyable. We also spoke a little bit about the Data Protection Reform Bill at the start. So if that's of interest to you, you can take a look. But there's not too much out on that at the minute anyway. So it was only a relatively brief chat. And we got pretty quickly into the main body, you know, retention archiving, as I say. So without further ado, we'll let you get into this. As Miles says, we'll be back next week for Data Breaches Part 1 and then Data Breaches Part 2. And then we'll be doing part two of this retention archiving chat in a couple weeks' time. If you want to invite to any of the live sessions, Miles mentions it potentially on the main body of the session, but you can get in touch with any of us for the link, or you can head to the DPP website and sign up on the events page. You'll be added to the subscribers list, and you will get the invite to the live session every single week. I think that's it in terms of plugs, guys. I don't think there's anything else that we need to plug. Miles, you normally have things that you need to plug, but I think that's it.
not this week. I would say, actually, if you are obviously working within the data protection industry, we are on the lookout for a QSA and for a security consultant, an information security consultant to come and join our organisation. So if you do have anybody who you could recommend, any listeners on this call, we'd appreciate you pushing that message out as we are growing continuously here at DPP.
Excellent. You know, come and join us. Come and get in on the podcast. You know, if you work here long enough, you will inevitably get the call up, won't you, Carrie?
Yeah.
She loves it, really.
Sorry, I was slightly distracted then. I just said yeah, as if I'd actually heard what you said then. I'm sorry. I don't know what I've agreed to. I could have agreed to anything just then.
That's fine. You're really getting the knack of this. You're a natural. Right, listeners, enough from us. We'll let you have more of us on the live session. So without further ado, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Carrie James and myself. Cool. Before we talk retention and archiving, we sometimes like to cover a little bit of what's been in the news. And I think we can't really go any further this week without talking about, I don't know what its official title is, but this Brexit reform bill, which depending on people's views on it, has potentially sent a bit of a panic across the sector, or some people aren't too bothered about it. But just for recap, Carrie, I think we all remember that the DCMS, or the ministry that looks after us, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, put out a proposal, how long ago? A few months back? 6 months ago? I forget.
Yeah, it might have been 6-8 months ago. It was quite a while ago now.
And effectively, it was a consultation where they put forward a number of kind of unstructured propositions for reforming the data protection landscape post Brexit, now that we're no longer in Europe and we can make our own laws, etc. Do we do away with the GDPR? How do we reform it, etc.? So that's what happened then, and now this is set to actually go through. They're set to be made law. There's a bill that will contain all of these proposed changes. Apologies, a little bit of feedback there. And that's been announced officially this week. I don't know what your thoughts are on it, Carrie, for the time being. Obviously, we've got nothing concrete yet. It's all just speculation primarily at this point as to what we're going to be getting. But I don't know if you had any initial thoughts about it. I certainly do, but I'll share mine in just a second.
Yeah, I was quite like Rick's just put, I was quite disappointed as well by the announcement. I was kind of hoping for more, just more basically. And now we've got to wait, I don't know if it's a couple of months now until the bill comes out, so we can actually get into more of the detail. I think it's maybe just, I don't know if it's just sort of like causing up a little bit of drama, but nothing really that we can actually do anything with right now. There's no particular obvious direction where we'd need to maybe consider changing the way things are done, and I'm not sure how much they're going to realistically stray away from the GDPR. Like, how much do they want to keep that adequacy with the EU versus risk losing that? Because whilst we've got the adequacy agreement, I think it was 4 years, like there is a thing in it that says that if we stray too far from EU law, that they will just revoke that adequacy and then we'll be without that.
Yes. Quite. No, I tend to agree with you. I tend to agree with the sentiment that we were expecting a little bit more. I think from my perspective, I don't really subscribe to some of the doom mongering around it for our sector. I think a lot of this is posturing, effectively. I think post Brexit posturing. I think there'll be some sound bites in there. There'll be a couple of sensible things. There'll be a couple of slightly less sensible things, as we saw with the initial, you know, proposal, the initial consultation, and as we saw with the Tiger report from a while ago. And I think that's a very good point about adequacy, because ultimately it's not something we would want to jeopardize, and particularly so as seemingly the rest of the world is coming up to GDPR standard, right? Increasingly, I believe even the Americans now are looking to work closer to that standard, which makes sense. You know, if there's a high grade standard that everyone is working to, then surely the aim is to bring ourselves up to that standard in order to facilitate things, rather than say, well, actually, we're not interested in your standard, we're going to do things differently. What we might see, feasibly, is a regime like perhaps they have in New Zealand, which I believe is slightly less restrictive, but is still deemed adequate. So we might see things like that. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm certainly not against change inherently. There are very good reasons to change some of the things that are currently in the law, but it has to be done sensibly and it has to be done proportionately, I think, most importantly.
Yeah, and like for a lot of companies in the UK as well, they are going to be processing data in Europe. So they're still going to need to be working to those European standards. So they may not really change what they do particularly too much, unless there's bits in this new legislation that they need to suddenly start doing, because it's actually something we don't do. But I think it'll be interesting to see the bill when it comes out. With that DCMS document, there was quite a few things in there, like the getting rid of the need for a DPO was quite a big one. And I was wondering, like, I think with some of that there's a bit of speculation that are they sort of saying these things to try and be like, oh, okay, then, well, we saw people weren't happy with that, so we'll give you that back and say, okay, we won't go through with that bit, whilst trying to like sneak through some other bit that they actually do want to put through.
Yeah, and
maybe I'm being cynical.
No, well, someone has to be in Dave's absence. It's the last shot. I'll take it, and I promise. Rick's echoing what we're saying, which is basically, you know, ultimately, the EU GDPR is not going anywhere, and a lot of businesses are going to have to continue to deal with that, and therefore, there's not really much scope to worry, I think, about it being scaled back. I can understand what Philip is saying in respect of there's potentially a risk that this is an incentive or at least a justification for certain people, certain businesses to take their foot off the accelerator a little bit with their compliance projects, to say,
yeah,
you know, if we're scaling back, well, we're also internally going to scale back. I can understand that. I'm not sure that will be allowed to happen. I think the changes, as I say, will be, for want of a better term, cosmetic almost. As I say, sort of sound bites. We're getting rid of DPOs, but we're going to keep someone who has to be accountable and responsible for data protection matters. Well, you know, what does that mean in practice? Nothing really. If you've still got an individual internally, it might mean some, you know, changes in terms of the landscape and the job market. But I'm not sure there's going to be anything too significant in respect of all of that.
Yeah, and I think since GDPR came in, a lot of organisations have put in a lot of work to get to where they are with like privacy first and embedding data protection as a culture within their workforce, that you'd hope that those organisations wouldn't want to go backwards from that and that they would want to keep that culture in place.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, thinking about the data subjects first.
Yeah, as Emma says, semantics from the government, I tend to agree in principle. I mean, I think a lot of it, I mean, arguably, none of our obligations, none of our responsibilities are going to get more difficult, which is one thing. let's be honest, it's all going to be simplifying / dumbing down where possible. Nothing's going to get more difficult. I'd be staggered if that were the case, quite frankly, because that's been their whole, what's the word I'm looking for? Their whole messaging around this has been, you know, get rid of the red tape, you know, empower business to use data. We'll free up £1 billion worth of GDP by doing this, or trade, business, whatever, which sounds like nonsense to me. But I mean, Rick makes a good point in terms of, you know, the risk is, and I guess this is what Dave and I have been talking about for a very long time over the past few weeks, particularly with developments in the US and other statutory reforms in the UK, is that the risk is that you start to erode public accountability. You start to erode... Oh, sorry, a little bit of feedback. You start to erode key rights, key obligations in this context. And then it's where is the line now? And at what point are we no longer comfortable with where the line is? Because there are very real knock-on effects of all of these changes in terms of what protection is afforded to people and their information and more broadly their person, you know? Yeah, I think it's tricky. There are some things that, yeah, I think will probably be a welcome change, but others which I'm less sure about. Philip is saying that cookies could get easier. Most people aren't cookie compliant anyway, so I don't think it's going to get easy for for a lot of people. I mean, that's an interesting one to look out for, is how is the implementation of the Privacy Directive going to change? That's, you know, that could be something genuinely to keep an eye on, because arguably, I think we have one of the more strict interpretations of the Privacy Directive, because I believe that unlike a lot of European geographies, we can't rely on the, you need consent for analytics purposes, whereas I think in certain other European countries, that's not the case, but I could be wrong on that front. Rick saying that Schrems 3 will be versus the UK. I genuinely wouldn't be surprised at this point.
I mean, I do think Schrems will come back at some point anyway. Even if it's not the UK, it'll be the new Privacy Shield thing that's going on.
Oh, well, that's just not going to last.
There'll be a new challenge.
not going to last. That, I think we spoke about that when it was first announced, but that's just... Yeah, the less said about that, the better. It's nonsense, quite frankly. The idea that you could somehow come up with this regime that is going to protect you from things like FISA, when literally last week we were talking about the fact that in the US they've made something like 3.5 million FISA requests last year, under Section 702 alone, which is only one part of the statute, is ludicrous. Ludicrous. Anyway, I'm slipping into Dave's shoes here.
I think this will be a good one for us to come back to when
I think
there's
so,
more
yeah.
detail out and about there. Did you say, were you and Miles thinking of doing a podcast special just on the bill when it comes out?
We'll definitely schedule a full session on the bill once it's out to analyse some of the content of that, to analyse some of the specifics and what it means for us all. Because I think that's something that we'll need to be on top of. Right, I think that's probably going to be it for that. As I say, I mean, there wasn't that much said, as you quite rightly said, Carrie. You know, it's a very light touch announcement, no real substance to it, so there can't be much substance to our analysis right now, unfortunately. So on that note, something which we can provide a lot more substance to are the topics of retention and archiving. So originally, I think it's probably important to set the scene, so I'm gonna work through some of our notes here that we've planned. So one thing that you've pointed out early doors is something to establish is what do we mean by a record. So do you want to take us through that?
Yeah. So I think it's important to understand what a record is, so then you know what you need to then manage, you know what you need to look after. As there is with like the ISO 27001 to do with IT, there is an ISO for records management that is 15489. And the ISO defines a record as information created, received and maintained as evidence and as an asset by an organisation or person in pursuit of legal obligations or in the transaction of business. It's quite a long wordy sentence, and I had to write an entire essay about that sentence as part of my degree.
Lovely.
It was not fun.
I mean, even ISO 15489 doesn't roll off the tongue quite as nicely as 27001.
No, it really doesn't. It's really not a nice number. No. But yes, it's sort of about keeping that record, and what is that record of? Is it, you know, it's got to be evidence, or it's got to be an asset to your business, and you're keeping it because you've got legal obligations, and it's being created as part of your transactions during business. So any, like, a lot of things can be records, like expenses, receipts, registers, anything could be a record. It's just sort of then deciphering which are the useful records to keep and which ones do you not need to keep as part of your records management.
So then you mentioned it there, records management. So that's kind of what we're talking about here, because obviously, just to, I suppose, set the scene a little bit, ultimately we are privacy people, you know, that's what we do, that's our bread and butter. But when we talk retention, it's almost impossible to talk about it in a context outside of records management, because this is one of the things I often get asked, is how do you separate your personal data as an asset from the information assets, from the record in which it's contained? And the answer is, well, you don't really. There are techniques, and maybe we can talk about that in a little bit, but ultimately it's much easier to just conceptualize it as being a records management task. So what do we mean by records management? You've put a nice definition down here for me.
Yep, again, from the ISO. The field responsible for the efficient and systematic control of the creation, receipt, maintenance, use and disposition of records, including processes for capturing and maintaining evidence of and information about business activities and transactions in the form of records. Again, another wordy sentence from the ISO. basically saying, you know, records management is, you know, controlling your records, you know, how they are created, how you manage them, how you might catalogue them or classify them, where you might store them, the security of them, and then, you know, how you're going to dispose of them at the end of retention.
Right, so
essentially, it's like the life cycle of a record.
That's exactly what I was about to say, managing the life cycle of the record through every stage of it. And I suppose that makes sense. It might sound a little bit reductive to talk about some, you know, concepts that we should all have an understanding, but I think sometimes it is kind of useful to go back and just make sure we're all in the same place with it. Mm. I mean, before we move on to how that interlinks and overlaps, I suppose, with the GDPR, because, you know, that's kind of an important point to cover here. One of the things outside of a legal obligation is how do you engage people with the concept? How do you put it across to the business, you know, that this is something that we need to be doing? Because obviously people, or at least, you know, businesses will tend to be more receptive to the idea that you have to do it because the GDPR says that you can only keep it for so long, X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
But actually, it's probably more constructive to get across the value of strong records management right from the start. So we'll talk a little bit about the practicalities of it, but like conceptually, how's that something that you, how do you get that across?
So it all sort of, a lot of it comes back through, you know, like everything else to do is policies. So you'd have policies, you'd assign people responsibilities, you know, you'd have monitoring and evaluation, you know, the policies working, is the systems working that you're using, and, you know, training as well, so people are aware of how they're supposed to be maintaining these records and looking after them, you know, and that they are aware that you shouldn't be holding on to things just in case.
Just in case culture being the arch nemesis of, you know, privacy people.
Yeah, that little phrase. Everywhere.
Yeah, we need it just in case. In case of what? We'll come to that in just a minute. But so as you say, you know, get it into policy, and from there on out, then you can look at the actual practicalities of it, which is kind of what Andrea's echoing in the chat there. So to bring it back to our GDPR perspective, ultimately, there is a very clear responsibility under one of the principles, Article 5, to only retain data in an identifiable format for as long as is necessary. Yeah. And I think part of the problem with that... Oh, sugar. Sorry about that. A little bit of feedback there. I think one of the things that is difficult for people in that context a lot of the time is that they want the law to be more prescriptive, right?
Yeah.
So you get businesses going, well, how long do we keep this for? And you go, well, actually, the GDPR just says as long as you need it. Mm-hmm. And my customers sort of love and hate it when I say that to them. I say, you know, you can keep it for as long as you need it. How long do you need it for? And they go, oh, can we have it for this long? And I go, well, why do you need it for that long? Oh, well, because this, well, that doesn't seem strong enough to me, you know. So we'll get into that in just a minute. But I thought it's important just to reconsider. Ultimately, that's what we're dealing with from a GDPR perspective. Now, as Rick quite rightly says in the chat, that's just one statutory instrument. If you look at industry guidelines, if you look at requirements, if you look at other statute. So he cites, for instance, the CIPD rules for HR, HMRC rules for tax records, NHS records, management code of practice, etc. You will find defined retention periods. So one of the key ones that we use, particularly when we're in social housing, is the National Housing Federation to put together a retention schedule, which is great. You know, it's fab. It contains it all there. Yeah, it's well put together.
And what I like is it tells you where they've based it on. So where they've based it on the Limitations Act, where they've based it on something else, or where they've decided that it's best practice, or if it's guidance from the ICO, guidance from the National Archives. I really liked how they defined where they've come up with those retention lines as well.
No, agreed, because ultimately, it's one of the number one things when someone says, well, can you review my retention schedule for me? I say, well, I can. But I can't necessarily tell you how long you should be keeping certain things. Now, over time you gain a better understanding of how long, you know, you should be keeping things just because you come up against them so regularly. So anything to do with the fulfillment of a contract, you say duration of engagement, duration of the contract plus 6 years, because you've got 6 years to bring a claim for breach of contract under the Limitations Act, right? That's one that sticks easily. Yeah. But if someone says, can you review my retention schedule? How am I supposed to do that? I don't know how long you need things.
It's difficult because, like you say, there's some that you learn through doing the work with different clients and different organisations that, yeah, this looks right, that looks right. And then sometimes it's that you've just got to challenge them to explain, okay, so you're saying you need this for 20 years, but why? Or the ones that really, not annoy me, but really make me question it is when they say indefinitely. Okay, so in like 3,000 years, you should still be holding this record. Why?
Yeah, I mean,
and then they do start to think, oh yeah, maybe indefinitely isn't quite right.
No, for sure. I mean, the reason I raise it is because a lot of the time you will see in a retention schedule that's been put together someone saying, oh well, we need it because the law says we need to keep it for that long. I say, okay, yeah. Well, what law? which bit of the law says that? Yeah. And a lot of the time people will roll their eyes and say, oh, you know, it says it somewhere. I know it says it somewhere, but the point is that accountability is baked into to all of the principles, to the law generally. And if you can't point to the specific bit of statute that says you need to keep it for that long, then your justification is not good enough, really. Now, you might find that actually it does say it somewhere in the law and you're not able to find it, in which case you revert to, I think as Andrea suggested somewhere, you revert to making a business decision and a policy decision about it. And you say, well, actually, there's nothing immediately relevant to us in terms of how long we retain this, so we're going to say that we need to keep it for this long, and we think that's proportionate because, and we've documented it. So, you know, there can be instances where you maybe stray from that strict statutory, you know, regimen, but ultimately the main thing is documenting it, right? Like, as long as you've got in right your justification. Like, I was helping a client, and we'll come to some of the more practical applications of all this in just a second, but I was helping a client with something the other week, and they were working with, I think I'm allowed to say this, but they were working with the British and Irish Lions rugby tours, right? Who I think you know more about rugby than I do, I think, Carrie, but Rob certainly does if he's listening. But I believe that they tour on a specific frequency and they tour specific locations. So they'll play in South Africa, for instance, every 12 years or something, because I think they tour every 3 years, but they do a different geography. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for converting. But anyway, that's just context, because they were asking me, well, in that context, we'd like to contact people about the next tour. So would we be okay to retain some of those contact details for 12 years? I said, well, do you think there's a reasonable expectation there? You know, that if you signed up for, say, you're in South Africa and you signed up because they're coming to your neck of the woods, would there be a reasonable expectation that in 12 years' time you're contacted by this same company about signing up for that tour, which is back in your neck of the woods after such a long period of time? I think it probably seems reasonable. It depends what you tell people, you know, as long as you're transparent about it. But
yeah, if they say we're going to hold it for 12 years and tell you when we're back,
it doesn't seem unreasonable. I mean, you also, there's things like maintaining regular contact so that it's not just, you've not heard from us for 12 years. Hello, here we are.
Yeah.
But my whole point being that, you know, a long retention period, I think this is the misconception. When the law says you can only retain it for as long as you need it, I think the tendency is to think shorter and to say, oh, well, we should only keep it for under a year or whatever. Whereas actually there might be very good reasons to keep things for a very long period of time, because simply the way of things.
And it just comes down to being able to justify that. If you can justify why you're keeping it and why you need it for that length of time, then fine. It's when you can't justify it that you need to start thinking about, right, well, when are we going to delete it then?
No, absolutely. And as Emma points out, ultimately it's a risk management, you know, exercise above all else, because you're effectively weighing up the risk of, and we'll talk about this more in greater detail in just a minute, but it's about weighing up the risk of holding an asset which you no longer need, which for a number of reasons could be problematic, whether it's from a compliance perspective, whether it's because that information could get breached, whether there's a cost associated with retaining that for longer, purely from a storage perspective, against potentially... Let me just get a little bit of feedback against the risk of you know, releasing, well, not releasing, but deleting, archiving, you know, getting rid of, effectively, for want of a better term, a document which down the line might be useful. Because you can't know that. I mean, that's the just-in-case culture again, but that's ultimately the risk you're weighing up. So from a practical perspective, because I do want to get onto archiving a little bit, because I think I have to set out my stall here, Carrie, which is that I often get frustrated with the posit, oh, we keep it for this long and then we archive it.
Yeah.
Which I see trotted out a lot.
Yeah.
And I get frustrated with that for two reasons. One of which is a lot of the time, it's not actually archived. It's just kept somewhere else. You know, we've put it in a different server on a different hard drive, in a different room. We've taken it out of live environments, maybe, but it's you've not archived it. You've just put it somewhere else.
Press the archive button on the document system online, and it puts it in a slightly different box.
Yeah, exactly. And the second reason being, why are you archiving? Can you not just get rid of it? So those are the things that's my perspective. You know, I'm not saying that there's not a value inherently to archiving. Please don't get me wrong. There absolutely can be. But just so that we're all in alignment here, my take on this is why are you archiving when you shouldn't be, I think, is going to be my perspective. So do you want to take us a little bit through what we mean by archiving fundamentally? Because it's something that is posited as a solution to the problem of retention, right? Retention's a headache for organizations. How do you enforce retention within a business? Well, we'll automate in our document management system or in our CRM, we'll automate the process that this particular record has a retention period, it has a shelf life of this long, and after that, we archive it. So it seems a solution to that. But what do we actually mean by archiving?
Yeah, I think from the notes, I'll start with a tiny bit of history about archiving. So actually, like, archiving as the concepts that you might think of it today, like what the National Archives do, or maybe like the British Library or local history groups, what they do as archiving, is actually quite a newer concept since about the First World War, when there was being obviously a lot of government action going on there because of the war, a lot of records being created. It was sort of like, right, they needed to figure out what they're going to do with all these records being created and how to tackle them. And archivists at that time sort of realized that only a small portion of these documents were worthy of permanent preservation, because obviously, again, you don't want to archive everything, you're going to archive the worthy stuff. And so they had to sort of come up with a system of how to look after them, document them properly. Archive and records management for me are like different branches on the same tree. There's quite a bit of overlap, which is why you'll find archivists that can do records management stuff and records managers that know about archives, because they sort of sit side by side. It's sort of a lot of archive. The difference with archive and records management is obviously records management is all your records that you've got to hold because you've got legal obligations, and you know, you need to evidence how you're doing your work and to hold yourselves accountable. Archives is like the best of the documents, the ones that show how you've done stuff or made decisions, but they should be only kept if you've, like, within a certain criteria.
Well, you know, it's
because they should have historical value for, like, or that you're collecting it for research purposes, perhaps.
Yeah, it's essentially
a collections policy to go alongside it.
And we can talk about that policy in just a second, but effectively records management applies to your entire estate, to your entire catalogue.
Yeah.
But your archive should be curated.
Yeah.
Right? It's that's the
curated
key word.
Collection, yeah. So your records will go through the life cycle, you know, you'll create the records, you'll use them, they'll go into semi-retention where, you know, that'll be when they start going through all the years of retention, and you might reach for it in year five, but you might not until it's gone. When it gets to the end of retention, does it go to heaven, go to archives, or does it go to hell and get disposed of, basically? All the, you know, only a few records should be going to the archives. The majority should be getting disposed of. So if there's an organisation that's just archiving everything as a matter of fact, then they probably aren't quite understanding what the archive should be. or they're using Archive as a second repository for everything until they can definitely press the button to delete it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because I've definitely seen instances where, and I think someone in the chat, maybe David, was saying this, that you see instances where they say, oh, we archive it for this length of time, which inherently doesn't make sense. But it's because, as you say, Carrie, they're using it as like a pit stop, if you like, a secondary retention, where they're saying, well, we keep it for this long in a live environment, then we take it out of the live environment and we keep it for a little bit longer, and then eventually we might delete it. But that's a misnomer, effectively, I guess, is what we're trying to say.
Yeah. If it's being held in an archive, there should be no retention date, because you don't have retention on an archive. You may, like, an archive may change its collections policy. It may change what it's about. And so there might be collections within their archive that they think, right, this is no longer relevant to us. But that's not because there's a retention deadline set. It's just it's not part of the collections policy. And it doesn't mean they're instantly going to delete and get rid of that information. They may try to, in most cases, try to find another archive that might take that information that's more relevant. But it's not that you'd ever put a retention on an archive document, because it's purposely being archived to be kept and preserved for future, you know, generations to come and look at and use in research and write papers on.
Of course. You mentioned there a collections policy.
Yeah.
You just tell us what you mean by that, because that's not a term that I was familiar with until we started talking about this.
Yeah, so ideally, archives should have a collections policy, and it sets out, you know, what kind of things they're looking for, what the purpose of their archive is, what kind of things they're interested in collecting, you know, the purpose of the collection. So it might be that if you've got you want to start a local history archive about your town, you know, you might be interested in collecting histories of people from in that town, might be interested in collecting old photographs from the town, old newspaper clippings about the town, and you would form your collections policy around that, you know, you're looking at local history about your town and you want to collect things about that. You're specifically interested in photo, old video footage, things like that. And you might set out with the purpose of being, okay, somebody approaches you, they want to give you their photos. You're happy to accept them because they're about your town. You wouldn't collect everything about everything. So the policies sort of whittles down what is going to come into your archive and what fits in. And it's a way of streamlining the kind of things you would save from your organisation. So a business might say, we want to keep records of significant events that have happened, but they specifically won't want to keep every nitty-gritty detail of things that have happened that might not have any importance.
Yeah, and I suppose this is where the complication comes in for a lot of the organisations that we work with, and a lot of private businesses, but also the public sector, admittedly. The only reason I make that distinction is because I think, generally speaking, although this is not universally true, of course, but I think archiving as a concept is usually more valuable to public institutions, right? Because it's what you're saying, it's about historical value. Now, that's not to say that there aren't private businesses that will have a perfectly good reason to do it, but you're talking about, as you say, like historical factors, evolution of a particular town, etc., something that the your local authority might be looking at. So that's the only reason I make that distinction. Yeah.
All public authorities, like councils, will have archives. You know, you've got the National Archives that used to be the Public Record Office. Universities will have archives. They usually all have one of their own. They might vary in size, but they usually have them. But there is actually quite a lot of sort of local history groups that will have their own, not quite archives, but they will have their own collection of stuff that you could go and view. Churches as well. York Minster have a really good archive. I went and dug through parts of that for my other degree. York University, they have a really, like, they have the Borthwick. That's a really big archive as well. I think there'll be more around than what you think there are. And it's not all public. HSBC have a really good archive as well. Got to go for a visit around that as part of my degree. That was really interesting to see.
Yeah, so
it could be anywhere, but it's just making sure that people are keeping things correctly and it's not records management by another name.
But ultimately, the main point being that there's, it, as you say, it has to be curated. There has to be a value to it. So I think that's what I mean by archiving, which I wanted to cover because, as I say on that stall, it's a bugbear of mine that often the term is used essentially interchangeably with records management, which is kind of what you were saying and what some people on the session are echoing here, that the two are used without much regard for what they actually refer to. So
yeah,
if we can maybe come back to the records management aspect a little bit, just to come back to what we do from a GDPR perspective,
yeah,
and talk a little bit about, you know, how we apply that in practice. So we were saying that ultimately you have to look to have your policy in place, whether that's, you know, just a data protection policy, whether it's a retention policy, whether it's a record hash policy, whatever you want to call it, but effectively that policy statement which sets out your approach, your requirement and your responsibilities in respect of how long you are keeping things and how you're going to do that.
Yeah.
And then subsequently you can look at how practically that happens. Now, what we see more and more of, and I think there's a perfectly good reason for that, is the automation of these processes, right? The yeah. businesses have tools available to them now that will do a substantial amount of the heavy lifting for them. And yeah. and you can't really blame businesses for doing that, can you? Because arguably, particularly with the, shall we say, the volume of records now that most businesses will handle and will process, having that helping hand of a system that will do the lifting for you is invaluable, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah. Especially since a lot of places now are going paper free anyway, so all their documents are going to be created digitally and they're going to be saved in systems, and it just makes sense to add, you know, timelines to them where the tools are there, because then you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to think, oh, we didn't do the archiving this year because of, not archiving, I've used the word there, we didn't do the deletion this year because of, you know, oh, COVID got in the way. If it's an automated system, you're always going to be then on top of it. You may have it set so you get a notification that in 30 days it's going to delete X amount of records, so you maybe have an opportunity there to think, oh, actually we need to keep these records for a little bit longer because of this reason. But I think if you've got the system there to employ it and make that job easier, then I think organisations should really be, you know, trying to use it where they can.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, ultimately, if you're, as I said, calibrating it properly, apologies, I'm playing with my mic a little bit because it's quite busy in the office today, but hopefully that doesn't carry across to any great extent. So yeah, I mean, if you've got the technology there to be able to support you, why wouldn't you use it? I think then the issue is actually, And one of the slight drawbacks potentially with systems, albeit a very minor one, because I think they are incredibly useful, is the problem is then that it feels like a quick fix to the solution. And culturally within the organization, you've maybe not had the shift that you wanted. Because if you're saying, guys, we need to, you know, stop over retaining everything, we need to stop, quote unquote, archiving everything, etc., we need to move towards actual, you know, stronger records management, we need to move towards having these processes in place, we need to move towards regular deletions, etc., I think there can sometimes be the case that, oh well, we've got this piece of kit now, isn't that the job done, you know, doesn't it
danger in people just thinking, oh, we don't need to worry about that, but you still need people to be accountable for it within the organisation, and for people to still know that they shouldn't be just creating information or creating documents just for the sake of it, because the system will pick it up and delete it in 6 years. You still want people to be mindful of, you know, data minimisation, not collecting too much data. And yeah, I think I lost my trail of thought a bit there.
That's all right. it can happen. But you do make a very good point there, and it's one that we obviously wanted to touch on, which is that while it can be easy to look at retention as an isolated issue and to look at it as effectively the management of the life cycle of that record, what is often forgotten, or what can be a little bit too easily forgotten, is that actually a lot of the other principles, if you are able to comply with them, will help you along that journey significantly. And you mentioned minimization there, which is one of our number one top tips. Well, not exactly a top tip, it's hardly rocket science, but you know, if you've not got it, you don't need to worry about how long you keep it, i.e. just make sure that you've got minimization embedded by default, you know, make sure that you're only collecting the bare minimum, and then you don't have to worry about effectively having to retain it. But also, key there, you also kind of touched on it very slightly, which is creating more records than you need. The amount of duplication you see, and again, this is partly the technology that we have available to us now. We can create documents like that,
yeah.
Fill them out, email them across, whatever, you know. But the problem is there that when you have tools like, particularly if you have shared drives, if you use like OneDrive or something like that, or some of the Google Shop products, which allow you to do collaborative work. I know that I have colleagues who have an incredible frustration, and I can understand why, where, you know, people are able to work on the same spreadsheet, just have one record. But instead of that, they create a copy, fill it out, email it to six people who all do their own copy, keep it on their, you know, whatever, their personal drive, email it across three or four times, and you end up with like 30 odd records of the same, or 30 odd copies, sorry, of the same record.
And then somebody's going, which is the most up-to-date version? I commented on this one, but my comment's not being answered on that one. And then nobody knows which one the most recent document is.
Well, there's also that.
It gets very confusing very quickly when you're emailing a document around and everybody's saving it and not working on the same one. When it's in an organisation and you can send links in an email to a document, there's no reason why you shouldn't be collaboratively just working on the same document.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, this is a little
bugbear of mine.
No, I mean, I completely agree with you. And this is where the whole technology point and the whole automation point, again, is the double-edged sword, right? Because the same technology that empowers you to do that is the technology which empowers you to create copies and store them on your own little space and whatever. So that they can easily be that frustration there. And it's something that I do see a lot of. But again, that reinforces the point around minimization. It also reinforces the point, and I think this is vital. We've not mentioned it yet, at least not clearly. We're talking about systems now. Data protection by design, by default. Making sure that the systems you're using, the apps, the products, whatever it is, the suppliers, are set up to be able to handle your retention practices. To handle your records management practice, because the number of times I have had someone say, oh no, we can't do a hard delete of the records in the system, it won't allow us to do that, that's not an acceptable excuse.
Schools had a massive problem when I worked with quite a few of them. A lot of schools use Sims, and Sims wouldn't let them delete anything. It would put it in a little hidden background place that was called an archive, I think, but it wouldn't actually let them delete anything. And that just was not, you know, that wasn't on. And I know Sims have since fixed that and schools now can delete from that. But this was post GDPR. It should be able to delete stuff. And this is when it comes up as you sort of find these as issues, because people haven't done a DPIA on a system and they've started using it. And then they find out after the fact they can't delete. But if they'd done the DPIA first, that would have been thrown up as an issue, because retention, dates, deletion is all covered as part of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the DPI point is a fabulous one, because I see it all the time that the DPI is not done soon enough or early enough in the process, or it's an aspect which is not sufficiently drawn out in that particular process to say, well, because what I do see a lot of is the retention point is asked in the context of DPI, and they go, oh, well, in context of activity, we'll keep it for this long, you know, and then we'll delete it. We'll securely delete it. Right, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Have you tested it? Are you actually able to delete records? Is it a soft delete? Is it a hard delete? You know, what happens? Or is it like some people were saying in the chat, it's called delete, but it's actually archived, or vice versa, you know? So the importance of getting that tested properly and being happy with it, again, it's the double-edged sword. Just to point out, I don't really want to make you know, any enemies with Sims, but people seem to be agreeing with what you're saying in terms of the frustrations. There's some emojis going into the chat reflection to it, which are quite amusing. David Smith asked a really good question, which is something which, in response to the suggestion, also I think it's worth pointing out just before I cover this, I talk about automation a lot here and potentially the drawbacks of it. But let me be clear that 90% of the time I'm advocating for automation, because I'm working with businesses who have nothing in place or very little in place. So I'm saying, let the kit do it for you. Outlook will, you know, automatically archive and then delete things for you, whatever. Like, you can set it all up to do what you need to do. So just to highlight that. But David makes a great point. He says, totally agree with automating as much as possible. It's the reviews that concern him. If someone gets an email saying that a record is due to be deleted, but then they don't review it, and then key records slash data could be lost, how do we get the balance between automation and the required reviews? And I get this all the time, right, Carrie, which is, you know, you say, oh, well, you just set a deadline on your emails that they're deleted after a year or whatever, which I think is what we've got internally. All of our emails are deleted after a year. Okay. And if you need, it's supposed to be anyway. And if you need to keep anything, then you file it away. Yeah. You know, we've got Salesforce for that. You put it on the system, or you file it in your OneDrive, whatever. Which there's an argument to say that then that just shifts the problem to places which are harder to police. That's an entirely different issue. But if you just apply that, you know, that does a lot of the work for you, as I'm saying. But often the response I get back to that suggestion is, oh, well, what if it deletes stuff we need? You know, there's emails in there that I might need. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
And my response to that is usually, is that actually true? How often do you need an email that's more than a year old and that information is not available anywhere else? I'm sure it can occur, but statistically, it's pretty rare. And the risk of that versus the risk of over-retaining all your records, because, again, risk is something which is quite hard to quantify in this context, but we've handled SARS, for instance, the subject access request, data subject access request, for businesses where instead of just deleting things, they've just quote-unquote archived all of their emails. And so someone who's been with the company maybe 40 years puts in a request, and all of a sudden you've got like 2.5 million emails to sort through, you know, like absurd numbers of emails to sort and work through. And that really is one of the risks in terms of like man hours, in terms of the compliance costs there. That's something quantifiable all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So just as a bit of a horror story, I suppose. I think
it's all like back down. I feel like a broken record saying it. I feel like everything comes back down to having your policies, getting training in place, and actually organizations holding their staff accountable to what they're doing. Because, you know, there should be people reviewing, you know, if they're being asked to review a record that may or may not be deleted, they should be actually doing that and not just ignoring it and then it being deleted. It, you know, getting it in people's job descriptions, if it needs to go that far, that, you know, this is part of your role, is, you know, organizing of this particular service area.
No, for sure.
More responsibility needs to take on by staff than maybe what there's sometimes. It's, I think people do hold stuff just in case, because they're scared to press the button to delete it. And I think you're right that, you know, the risk of deleting stuff versus the chance you may need to find it again is probably quite rare, especially if you've been putting things, you know, moving emails where you need to properly anyway, like the ones that actually have this is, again, comes down to records with value. You know, we only, like, I only put the emails on Salesforce that have value, that show bits of work I've done that say, yes, this is what I've done with this client, that have value. I don't put every single email onto Salesforce because not all of, like, a lot of them don't have any value. It's organizing a meeting. Well, once the meeting's happened, I can just put, like, anything to do with the meeting outcome onto Salesforce. And it's getting people into that habit of documenting the doesn't need to be kept and deleting the emails that don't need to be kept, rather than just keeping them just because.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, you make a key point there, which is about the accountability and actually making people accountable, you know, building it into their core responsibilities. Because all too often, and this is a broader point than just the retention point, I think this is a broader compliance point, you see organizations that have a nominated person who's accountable for data protection, whether it's a DPO or whoever it might be, and they're left to it, and they end up in a situation where they're battling the rest of the business, and the rest of the business is going, oh, the GDPR person said I can't do this, the GDPR person said I have to do that, you know, but they are not themselves accountable. And really, that's never ever a sustainable model, because you have to have people on the ground accountable for what they're doing and responsible for what they're doing, because otherwise you're never going to get anywhere with it. I just wanted to quickly cover, do you know what, we've only got 5 minutes left. I have genuinely no idea where the time has gone. That's extraordinary. But I'm happy to keep talking, because we started a little bit later, and to be honest, I feel like we've barely scratched the surface.
No, there is more in there in the list that we haven't spoke about.
Absolutely. But I wanted to cover a point that Rick makes, because actually I hadn't accounted for this. I hadn't put it on the list, but it's a very, very, very good point, which is, remember to add data lifecycle to DPAs, data processing agreements, to ensure that your processors archive, return, purge as necessary. And yeah, fabulous point, because how often do you see, you know, entire processes dedicated to appointing and managing the onboarding of new suppliers of new data processors? You go through the process, you know, you put them through due diligence, you get your DPA reviewed and signed. We talk about that a lot, but then it comes to decommissioning and all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, we stop working with them, take them off the register. It's like, well, are you going to make sure they've deleted your records? Are you going to get them back?
Yeah.
No, it's fine. We don't need it. It's like,
I mean,
it's
what Rick said there actually makes me think of, what about processors that you have a very long-standing relationship with, say you've been working with them for 10 years. Like, are they actually told at any point during that 10-year period that actually you should delete this at 6 years because actually it's no longer needed then? Or is it just left to the point of the DPA where it's saying at the end of the contract you'll then delete all the data? So would they be holding all data for 10 years? You know, did processors do any retention activities on control the data partway through a contract if it's a long-standing one?
Yeah, that's a fantastic point, because I have seen a couple of very mature organizations who will have their yearly audit of suppliers. And as part of that, they will check in with those suppliers and go, right, well, what are you currently holding for us? Is there anything that we can purge? I mean, that's extremely labor intensive, but they're only able to do that because the volume of records with which they work is not massive, and therefore it's feasible to do that. But,
yeah,
you know, that's particularly high standards, not always necessarily possible. But it's a fantastic point, because how often does it get forgotten about? It? As you say, if you've been working with a particular supplier for 10 years, which is not that uncommon, are they keeping everything for 10 years? Do they need to? Who knows? Stephen's asking, are you aware of any published case studies where organizations have reduced the email retention period and how this was managed by the organization? I'll be honest, I'm not aware of any published ones. I've been involved in ones with customers where they've literally just said, that's it, 6 months, you know, or a year, and everything gets deleted. And they've turned it on with, you know, relatively short notice, all things considered, you know, maybe a month or two. And it's worked brilliantly. They've had no issues with it. You know, they have systems in place where they can store the records that need to be stored. But, you know, they're happy with it. And all the complaints initially that were, well, what happens if there's an email I need? None of those have actually materialized in practice. That's not to say that it will necessarily work for every organization, of course, but every instance I've seen where it's been applied and there's been just sort of a ruthless 6 month to a year and then we get rid of it has worked. So
yeah,
it's hard for me to argue against it, in all honesty.
Yeah, at this point in time, trying to make sure everybody understands that email isn't supposed to be used as a storage system, as a permanent storage. Email's a vehicle to putting that information somewhere else.
Yeah.
Should be permanently kept, so that having a 6 month retention on your emails shouldn't be an issue in theory.
Yes. Caroline raised an interesting anecdote where she says, yes, agree to life cycle. As part of a DPIA following GDPR, a data processor advised that they didn't delete data unless we authorized them to do so. A school had used this organization for over 10 years, and we subsequently got 10 years of data deleted, which they were happy to hold. I mean, that's kind of the point, right? Because ultimately, from an ownership perspective, from an accountability perspective, as a processor, they're not liable for applying those retention criteria, right? Like, ultimately, as a controller, it's your data, you have to be responsible for it. And so why would, unless you're one of these really, really proactive organizations as a processor that tries incredibly hard to make compliance easy for their controllers, which, you know, is more and more common. But unless you're one of those, what's your incentive to go to manage that proactively? What's your incentive to really go above and beyond, other than purely, you know, the commerciality of being a quote-unquote compliant solution, if there's such a thing? What's the incentive? I mean, it must be limited, because it's something that then you have to manage, and there's a resourcing associated with that.
Yeah, it could be something that controllers look to maybe add into the data processing agreements, that after X amount of date, if the contract's still ongoing, there'll be a conversation about data currently held, so that there is something put there. Whilst your DPA needs to cover Article 28 requirements, I want to say Article 28.
Yes, that's correct.
yeah, Article 28 requirements, it doesn't mean it only has to have that in it. You can add whatever other clauses into it that you see are relevant and fit for purpose.
Yeah,
nothing to stop you adding things to say and apply a retention schedule to the information you hold as a processor.
Yeah, 100%. And there's a couple more good points. God, the chat is really on fire today. This is clearly a popular topic. We might have to have a second episode on this, because I do feel like we've barely scratched the surface, and actually we've just hit our allocated time. But we'll keep going for a couple more minutes if that's all right with you, Carrie.
Because
there are good points in the chat that I want to pick up. One thing's Rick says, and actually I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, and Rick, actually, if you've got any thoughts on it. I do often hear this argument of people saying, you know, one of the key arguments in favor of, you know, stringent records management processes is that storage, you know, there's a storage cost associated with that, and storage ain't cheap. But is that really true? I mean, obviously at a certain point there's going to be a potentially higher cost associated with it, but I've always thought that, even though I don't challenge it because ultimately it's someone arguing my point, I've always thought that's a bit of a weak argument. But maybe I'm unaware of the actual cost of storage, but I often feel like that's a strangely weak argument. I don't know if you've got thoughts on that, Carrie.
Well, I don't really know how much storage online costs, and I'll be honest, I don't know, I've not had to pay for it. But I do use cost as a key point when I'm explaining in training about why retention is important, because I think sometimes if you're trying to convince like the board or senior leadership of something, that sometimes it's the money aspect that can make them listen. Mm-hmm. And so I think, saying that the more you're holding stuff unnecessarily, the more cost there's going to be associated with that. And the larger the organisation you are, the more work you're doing. Say you're a housing association with 30 or 40 houses, that is a lot of paperwork being generated on tenants. You know, the larger you are, the more storage you're going to need. So it could scale up to something quite costly. It could be that if they're holding a lot of paper records, that they're having to rent storage, and that's a quantifiable cost. If they're not holding the paper records anymore, then you can actually get rid of that storage.
Yeah, 100%. And actually, there's another point here, which is that a point which a couple of people are making in the chat, which is more importantly, particularly on the email front, but we've already mentioned it, that one of the key benefits, particularly from a risk management, from a costing perspective, is that if you don't retain these things, or if you have very curated records management, if you minimize the amount of records you have, those are all records, if they don't exist, which cannot be accessed under a subject access request.
That's what I always remind them in training. Can't be accessed under SAR. You can't breach it if you haven't got it. It can't be asked for under FOI if you haven't got it.
That, oh my God,
plenty,
Carrie,
plenty of benefits to retention. It's just
one of the most infuriating things. One of the most infuriating things is when you're dealing with a breach and they say, "Oh, we should have deleted this. It's outside its retention."
It just gets a little bit embarrassing sometimes, and it's like, "Why are you holding it then?" God.
Yeah, you know, if you'd have just deleted this, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't.
It's going to be awkward, especially if it's a bad one and you've actually got to tell the data subject about it, and then you've also only got to tell them you breached the data, but also that you're holding it for absolutely no purpose whatsoever.
And that's where really. I mean, obviously our own regulator, and I really we've done well not to bash our own regulator on today's episode, but normally it's a recurring theme. But even though it's quite unlikely that they'll come down on you, arguably that's the sort of thing where you can compound your issues, right? If you've had a breach, and then on top of that what becomes apparent is that your retention criteria are all over the place or simply non-existent, then it can really compound things.
I think that they probably wouldn't. I'm not sure whether it would affect a fine so much, but you know, like in the letters that you get back from them saying you need to consider this, consider that, I think they would pick up on retention as an issue to be addressed in your organisation, because it's a factor in the breach as well, I think. You're not complying with the principles by holding information longer than necessary, so you're breaching the principles by not doing your retention properly, and then you've also breached personal data anyway. It's kind of just compounds the problem.
It most certainly does. You'll have to forgive me if I sound distracted, but Phil's currently ferreting around me. So Phil's in the office today. He couldn't make this session, but he is in the office and he's ferreting around looking for microphones. Are you coming on? No. Anyway, this is starting to spiral now. Rick very helpfully provides some of the breakdown actually on that costing point of storage, which I genuinely was not aware that that's how it worked. According to Rick, potentially also runs into the hundreds of thousands when people are saying just add another pay to buy it. That's, yeah, quite extraordinary. We are running out of time, although I could happily sit and keep talking about this for a long time because it is, as I say, I have a number of frustrations with this specific area, I think. But really, our key things for today, and if people are interested, do let us know and we'll do a follow-up episode and we'll try and address some of the more practical concerns, because we've talked quite conceptually, I think, today, which wasn't necessarily the intention, but it's important to cover some of these concepts before we can talk about the practicalities of it. So yeah, maybe there's scope to do another session.
And actually, one of those things you need to understand why you're doing it to be able to do it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And actually, we've just had an opening in the calendar for events, I believe, Producer Miles. So we can possibly do a follow-up event. People are supporting that on the session. Okay, excellent. Well, we'll look at getting that booked in. But I think some of the key things we wanted to get across today, and obviously, Carrie, feel free to say otherwise, but some of the key ones we wanted to get across is, from a retention perspective, let's talk about archiving. What do we actually mean by archiving? I certainly feel like I have a better grasp on it after that. So thank you, Kerry. But what do we mean? You know, not everyone actually has to do it. In fact, most people don't need to do it. Most organizations don't need to do it. And if you're going to do it properly. You know, don't do it in halves. I'm trying to think of the politically correct way to say that. You know the expression I was going to say.
Yeah, I was thinking, am I allowed to say that? And then decided not to.
Yeah, well, Stuart asked, very kindly asked us if he could swear on this podcast, which we try not to. But yeah, if you're going to do it properly. Go all the way. So that's one of the things. Don't use archiving interchangeably with records management. It's not the same thing. And I think broadly, forever, our top tip and our closing thought on this subject is you don't need to worry about retaining it if you don't have it.
Yeah.
Just don't collect it in the first place. Get rid of it.
Yeah.
And I think, is that a summary for today's session? Have you got any other thoughts?
No, I think that's a pretty good summary, but I agree. I think there's more that we could talk about on this topic. And Miles says the 10th of June is free.
10th of June is free. So for those interested, 10th of June.
Are you going to be available on 10th of June, Ollie? I know you're off for quite a lot of June, aren't you?
I suspect I might not be here for that, but that's fine because I'm not the key person on this retention chat. The key person is my colleague here, Carrie. So as long as Carrie's about on the 10th of June.
I am around. Yes.
Perfect. Excellent. Well, there seems to be, people seem to like the idea. So we'll get that set up. For now, let's adjourn because we're already 10 minutes over and Mars and I need to record this intro before my next meeting at 2. So and we need to adjourn this. But thank you ever so much, Carrie, for your time and your insights this afternoon. I've thoroughly enjoyed that. As I say, that hour has absolutely flown by. I have no idea where it's gone.
Yeah, it's been really interesting as always. And I think we've had some really good comments in the chat today.
Yes, thank you all very much in the chat and all those in attendance. Well attended today and some really, really great interactions. Hopefully we can do this topic justice on the next session when we get that booked in. But we've really enjoyed having you all with us. As I say, the interactions are always one of the best parts of this. We are back next week. In fact, I forgot to mention that this is the first in a run of 3 weeks of you attending these, Carrie, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the next two, I did suggest the topic. So I can't just suggest a topic and then run. I actually have to come and do my topic.
So what's your topic then?
We are going to be talking about data breaches for the next 2 weeks. What one is, how to identify one, what to do if you have one. I'm sure we can come up with some horror stories that are horrifying and hilarious.
Oh, yes.
If people have their own questions about potential, like any data breach things, bring them along. Yeah. We can answer them.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll be talking data breaches for the next 2 weeks. That we've already planned that in advance and booked in a double header, which I think is probably a sensible thing to do. We might just have to start doing that going forward, quite frankly, because we're going to end up finishing these and saying, we could do another week's worth. But thank you ever so much for your time. I'm looking forward to our chat next week about data breaches part one. For those of you who currently do not have an invite, I'm seeing in the chat, you can either head to the DPP website under the events page to sign up, or Producer Miles can get in touch with you afterwards and send you an invite directly, add you to the subscribers list, and then you'll get the invite every week for the sessions. If you can't make them, then they are released afterwards in the form of the podcast, as I said at the start. So without further ado, I will adjourn this for today. But as I say, thank you all very much for your time. Thank you for your attendance, and we will see you all next week.
Yep. See you later.
Bye.